We have the most expensive healthcare system in the world, and we have the worst outcomes among developing nations.
And what I learned along the way was the bureaucratic resistance to a new idea in healthcare is unbelievable. Unbelievable to the point where people who had the power to do it came to me and said, "You're going to prison for building this."
We spend $4 trillion treating diseases that could be prevented for a fraction of the cost.
If I catch cancer at stage one, it's a lifestyle change. If I catch cancer at stage four, it's a doctor and a facility saying, chemo, radiation, surgery, your life is definitely going to be changed. You probably will die.
$800 billion to $1 trillion in annual savings, benefits for everyone and every political party, and we can improve our life expectancy by 4 years.
The best way to get the train started on fixing this shit is to just be openly talking about this all the time and let every single representative and anyone you have access to in government that represents you, let them know that this is your number one issue. So we have a very special episode today. We have the usual suspects. We have Larry and Hans and myself. But we also have a very special guest who I'm going to have introduce himself here in a few seconds, Michael Gorin. And the reason why he's a very special guest is because today's topic is healthcare. And healthcare is, an issue that the United States has been trying to grapple with for decades. And it's becoming an unsustainable problem from a spending perspective. And in this podcast, we're going to do the unthinkable, which is try to solve the problem. And Larry has done a ton of work and a ton of research in trying to understand what are the variables that are most important. But Michael brings a very specific set of knowledge and experience that I think is going to give the audience a lot of context and a lot of understanding as to perhaps how complex and how entrenched and how difficult of a problem this really is, and potentially a lot of great solutions that, you know, are out there that perhaps for some reason our government is not taking on. So, Michael, I'm going to throw it over to you to introduce yourself and also make sure you tell people about your brand new book as well.
Okay.
So go for it.
I am an electrical engineer who did graduate work in physics and then went to law school. And I also am a 15-time serial entrepreneur. And I think most significantly to the discussion today is Teladoc. When we started Teladoc, I thought we were going to solve an access problem and thereby solving many of the problems in healthcare. And what I learned along the way was the bureaucratic resistance to a new idea in healthcare is unbelievable. Unbelievable to the point where people who had the power to do it came to me and said, "You're going to prison for building this." And that was the big lesson in, as an entrepreneur, we expect challenges. We don't expect challenges that big. And as we learned the nuances of healthcare, we also learned how to gently convince and change things so that we could fix a problem.
Yeah. And so for the public that may not be aware, what is Teladoc?
Teladoc is, the simplest description is, it is a doctor, a telephone, and a patient with a medical record and all the resources the doctor needs so that a patient with a minor issue can be diagnosed and, if necessary, a prescription written, so long as that prescription is not a narcotic or a controlled substance.
Got it. And this was the first of its kind when y'all built this, correct? This, you basically laid the foundation for telemedicine.
The foundation started in 1967 with a man who turns 89 this month named Jay Sanders, a medical doctor. But Jay ran around the country, around the world, planting seeds, and nothing happened until we started Teladoc. And Teladoc, just for scale, is now 96 million lives in their medical record database, which makes them twice as big as United Healthcare, who everybody thinks of as the largest healthcare company.
Wow. So, and that's going to be supremely relevant to this discussion because that sort of your description of the walls you hit with building Teladoc, I think is going to be such a wonderful bit of context to the entire healthcare discussion, because those are like the repeated motifs or the themes that I keep hearing about. Really, anything related to government, it's just like it literally they will try to throw you to jail if you're trying to solve something really complex, you know?
Yeah.
Real quick, before I throw it over to Larry, maybe a few seconds on your background and then the book that you just released.
Sure. So let me go right into the book, because it sort of describes everything. When I talk about states that sent sheriffs to our office to say, you're going to prison for building Teladoc, in retrospect, the investors always say, what keeps you up at night? And if you're an intrepid entrepreneur, the answer is nothing, until a sheriff comes into your office and says, you're going to prison. and that happened so many times that we decided to write a book about it. In fact, I mentioned that Jay Sanders is now turning 89 this month. And I called him a few months ago and said, let's write a fiction book about the history of telemedicine. That way we can tell the whole story, make it fun, but not incriminate the bad guys, because we'll change all their names. And so what we did was we wrote a book called Telemedicine Wars. Yesterday was the release date. It hit number one Amazon bestseller this morning.
Congratulations.
And that was our real goal. You know, it was fun writing the story, although there was a fair amount of PTSD, I will admit. But the goal was to get our 89-year-old friend, Jay Sanders, that number one bestseller status. And we did.
That's fantastic. Everybody, make sure you go check that out. We'll put a link for that in the description in the comment section below. Let's just make it number one globally, you guys. Come on. Let's yeah, take it number one global. There you go.
So a few words about Michael before we continue.
Yeah.
Michael is being, you know, extremely modest. He's not giving away the half of it. He's an author. He's got these three, you know, advanced degrees. But he's also, you know, a fantastic helpmeet to entrepreneurs. He gives incredible advice, and he knows everybody in the world. And everybody loves him. And so it's just been a joy and a pleasure to become, you know, one of his friends. I think I can call myself that. And to have him as one of my friends. So it's an amazing experience. So I just thought I would mention that. And I'm sure he'll bring, you know, all of that to our little story here today.
Awesome. Yeah, we're very happy to have Michael on the podcast, Larry. So let's throw it over to you and get us started on your slides. Let me throw them up here. And we'll start sort of talking about this. Before you show the slides,
let me give a little bit of background. Just hide the slide at the moment, because you're kind of...
Oh, sorry.
You're putting the headline out
face.
There. But let me just make a few points. I did this study, which turned out to be a 90-page paper. You know, I always use more words than are necessary to say the things I want to say. This one got to many thousand words, and it was a result of my reading about Doge, reading about this big, beautiful bill, reading about Elon's concerns. And, you know, some time ago, I also did a study on the overall budget deficit and what was contributing to the deficit and where that was going. And here's the reality. Even if Congress today passes, you know, cuts, extreme cuts, cuts defense, cuts this tremendous amount of waste, fraud, and abuse, cuts the programs that seem to, you know, give money for nothing, and blah, 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 it's not going to solve our problem. Our problem grows through two particular agents. The one is Social Security, which is a great pity, because Social Security could be fixed so easily, it's just a joke. That's one problem. And the other problem is healthcare. The growth of healthcare is eating our nation. It is the single biggest contributor to the rise of our deficit. and in the out years appears to be even greater. And so as I studied the problem and tried to, you know, grapple with this whole issue, I tried to go to first principles, and the first principle told me that even legislation by Congress would not be able to solve or stop this problem. This problem is so great, so complex, and so immense that legislation alone, leadership in the White House alone, leadership in Congress alone, leadership in the Supreme Court alone, and all the above will not solve this problem. Let's look at the size of the problem. Let's go to that first slide, Farzad. So I call it the $4.9 trillion crisis. By the way, Elon is bemoaning the fact that we're going to have a $5 trillion deficit. What is the size of healthcare spend? Just coincidentally, $5 trillion. It's 17.6% of GDP. 17.6 and growing constantly. You know, just less than 10 years ago, it was 12% of GDP. Think about that. It's almost 50% higher in 10 years. Go ahead.
Just to make sure we're clear here. So the $5 trillion number, this is total annual healthcare spend in the United States.
Yes.
Correct.
Yes.
Okay, got it.
17% of our gross domestic product. And we, and you think that's fine as long as everybody's healthy as a result. But the truth is, we are literally the last. We score the lowest of capability of all developed nations. Not of some, but amongst the 10 developed nations in what they call the Commonwealth Fund rankings, we are number 10. And 90% is spent on preventable diseases, $4.5 trillion annually. So it's not that the budget, $4.9 trillion of the budget, goes to healthcare. It's the budget plus all the dollars out of our pockets. We have the most expensive healthcare system in the world, and we have the worst outcomes among developing nations. And the truth is, both parameters are getting worse every year. We're becoming more expensive and our outcomes are going down. I mean, guys.
I mean, it's almost like, it's like unbelievable. Like it's like, it doesn't compute when I hear that, right? So it's like, it feels fake. It's like when I hear those numbers put on the screen, it makes me feel like there has to be some sort of mathematical error. Like we're not looking at this properly, but it's the truth, right? And I think that's very important to drive home. It's the truth. We spend the most, we have the worst results, and 90% of the overspend that we do is preventable.
And here's the thing. I mean, look, anybody can contest these numbers. They're very welcome to. I will post the 90-page study I've done. I've run it by Michael. I've run it by several other people. Nobody's contesting the numbers. Nobody's challenged those numbers. And I started by challenging these numbers when I saw the number at first. I mean, I simply grokked it, and it was just incredible. So that's what got me, you know, going down the rabbit hole. And believe me, I went down a rabbit hole. And I don't want to go through all 20 slides today. I want to touch the key issues and just get validation on those key issues.
I think the answer is in that third stat, the 90%. And when I was building Teladoc and nobody knew what it was, I used to tell people this. Farzad will get this because he lives in Austin. In Texas, we have these little creatures called fire ants. They're little tiny.
Hate them.
They're little tiny specks. If you step on them, they will hurt you for a week. And in healthcare, what we do is we walk out in our front yard we see fire ants and we call the Pentagon and they send a platoon with air support. That's how we fix problems in healthcare. And the reality is, every smart Texan has a little, a bag of something in their garage. They go out and get a teaspoon of it. That's what we need to be doing in healthcare in the United States. We don't need to bring the most complex solution to the simplest problems. And Ben Franklin had a great quote, which in our now antiquated American system was, an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. And I said antiquated because I love the metric version. What's the difference between an ounce and a pound? 16 times? In the metric system, it would be a gram of prevention is worth a kilogram of cure. That's 1,000 times difference. And if we can follow Larry's third stat there and say, how do we catch things before they get expensive and dangerous, then we could make 1,000x difference in the cost and delivery and quality of care.
Can I add one thing to that, Michael? Our healthcare system and our behavior, because you can't separate our behavior as a society from our healthcare system, you're going to see the two are inextricably mixed or intertwined. In the fire ant story you tell, what we are doing is we are going out into fire ant territory bare feet, you know, on purpose.
Yeah.
It's not just that we are treating a fire ant bite with, you know, helicopters and all kinds of expensive stuff, but that we are going out into fire ant territory ready to be bitten.
Yeah. And then the platoon comes. So we willingly,
yes,
right?
Yes.
So we make stupid decisions and then we accept the most ridiculous response, right? So
yes.
And then let me ask a question about that, Michael. So how much of the so there's a behavioral aspect, there is an action aspect. Okay. On the action aspect, how much of that the comment you said is like we come up with the most complex solutions for the simplest problems. Mm-hmm. How much of that is because the healthcare system in the United States is captured by the lobbyist groups or by like pharmaceutical companies to where they have every incentive in the world to do the most complex thing possible because they will make the most money? And this is what I hear a lot, right?
Yeah.
So how do you think through that? Like, let me know.
I think the solution is almost always a good doctor and a good immune system. And what we've done is we've injected payers and all these bureaucratic entities into our system, all of which are making more money than the doctor. And how do you carve that out? They're making the money. They control all of the cards on this game. And the doctor is really not, the doctor is just trying to provide care. They don't know how to navigate this system. And so the patient is just subject to, I'm sick, what do I do?
That's definitely a major contributing factor. There's no doubt about it. But it's the patient behavior as well. The patient has gone out, stamped on the fire ants purposefully, and then, you know, come to the doctor and said, how can I help? And the platoon comes in. So it's a multiple level problem.
It's the worst of both worlds.
It's the worst of many worlds, and not just one world. There are actually many worlds.
Yeah.
So in picking and choosing what I want to show is I'm kind of skipping ahead a little bit, but we literally spend twice as much as our peers. Healthcare spending in the United States is 17.6% of our GDP. The OECD average, the developed world's average, is 9.2%. Japan's 10.7, France is 10.9, Germany's 11.1, Switzerland 11.7. Look, I've had to consult a doctor in Germany. Cost me almost nothing. and the treatment was as good as any doctor/hospital I could have got in the United States. So our per capita spending is running at almost $13,500 in 2023. Believe me, in 2024, it's up by almost 10%. And Switzerland is 9,900 in that same year. So I'm not going to berate the whole spending thing much more, but and I could go on. I mean, there's several slides that compare us. I'm just going to skip by them. I'm just going to talk about our health outcomes. Look at our life expectancy, everybody. Our life expectancy is 78.4 years, which means I'm dead. I'm older than 78.4.
This is so actually a hologram of Larry.
This is my hologram speaking. But in the OECD world, I could expect to live another 4 years, 3 years. So 4.1 years shorter. We live 4.1 years less than they do in the whole of the OECD world, which spends so much little money. Our infant mortality is 5.5 per thousand births. It's worse than every single country in the OECD. And preventable deaths is rising in the United States, and it's falling in the OECD. Our life expectancy rank in the world is 46th.
Crazy.
Think about that, guys. 46th in the world. Our healthcare system performance is the last among the 10 developed nations. Our infant mortality, we are 33rd out of 38. So the paradox is simply the highest spending per capita, worst outcomes amongst developing nations, and 28 million of us are uninsured, and 45 million are underinsured, making a total of over 73 million people who are either under or uninsured. And yet we spend twice as much as other countries where our citizens live shorter lives. How does that compute?
Yeah. And for the underinsured, uninsured equation, so from the research, is it purely a cost thing? Is it just too damn expensive to have health insurance in this country?
Oh, it's such a complicated answer to give you. The answer in simple terms is not really. But when we see the insurance landscape, what we're going to find is that everybody who's insured through what we used to call Obamacare or directly with the government pay a lot less than those people who are insured in private insurance that pay many times as much, driving up the cost of healthcare very significantly. You're going to see how the mechanism works. And so those people who are insured through Obamacare or through the government programs or through personal programs, their costs are rising very dramatically because they're being driven by this overinsured, or let's call it monopoly insurance, that is being run by the corporate insurance. So you have this incredibly incestuous relationship between the insurers, the providers, and the corporations. And the poor people who are insured are being dealt with a terrible, terrible hand. And we're going to get into that. And all of that comes from the lack of price transparency. And I'm going to get into that. So I don't know if that answers your question, but at the highest level possible, our insurance environment is so out of kilter, it's so unbalanced, that it is one of the principle, there are many, but it's one of the principal factors contributing to this incredible poor performance and high cost. Okay?
Got it.
Care should be, again, I'm going to harp on this because it's really important. It should be a doctor and a patient. And Johns Hopkins did a study that is absolutely alarming. What they wanted to figure out is how many deaths in the United States every year from medical mistakes. Now, before I tell you what the number is, I want to go back. When I was an electrical engineering student, we thought we were the smartest people in the university. This one, UT. And in retrospect, I look back at it and I see the things that those people who went to medical school had to do were much more complex than what we had to do. We just had to make good grades in our classes. They had to make good grades. They had to make straight A's and build relationships and do all the other things. The reality is those people who became medical doctors really were the smartest people. And they were doing it because mostly they wanted to save lives. So the Johns Hopkins study, 250,000 deaths in the United States a year because of medical mistakes. How wow. is it that doctors, the smartest guys are and women are making mistakes that are killing people? And I think the answer goes back right to where Larry is again, and that is follow the money. Doctors are trying to make enough money to pay all their bills, and they're overworking. Everybody knows that the more you work, the more tired you get, the more mistakes you make. And these providers who are giving us care, if they were well-rested and relaxed all the time, we'd get far better care. And that's probably what they are in Switzerland and Germany. In the United States, they're overworked, overtasked, not because they're not as smart as the Germans or the Swiss, but because they're trying to work harder to pay the bills, to keep up with the expenses. And this is a huge part of it. I mean, remember mom always told us, follow the money and you'll find.
Wow. So just one more point to the issue of price blindness. You know, I mentioned that we don't understand what we're spending, because if we're buying government supported or government, or if we're buying through, you know, the internet, our insurance, it's a lot cheaper than if we are getting insurance from our corporation, which are paying a lot more money. But here's the paradox. There are 330 million of us, roughly speaking, right? 28 million of them are uninsured and 45 million are underinsured. But none of us see the true costs until after we've actually been to the doctor or been in the hospital. Have any of you guys ever requested a cost from your hospital or from your doctor before you've had a procedure?
Not me.
What else in your life have you bought, expensive item that you have you bought without checking the price?
I don't want to say.
I'm not talking about your wife. I'm talking
there
about
may ha- No, I'm talking about a few bottles of wine I may have ordered without knowing how much it costs.
Okay. But in serious terms, I will tell you a story. A friend of mine, I don't want to point fingers and I don't want to mention names. His wife went to have a hip replacement. He's covered. His company covers his insurance. He got the bill after the fact. It was $25,000.
With insurance?
No, his insurance were going to pay, but they wanted him to pay the first loss.
Yeah.
He figured out that if he paid that himself and not paid the first loss, he'd be better off in terms of the following year. Bottom line is, that same procedure, less than half a mile down the road, would have cost him $8,000, which if he had claimed on insurance, he would be 100% covered.
So I've tried to play devil's advocate with this, like this weird market that healthcare is in the United States. Like, what would be the justification?
It is not a market. It is not a market.
Right. It's not even a market, right? So like, what is the justification for hiding prices?
So there was a law passed that everybody has to publish their prices. But because of the complexity of pricing, there's no way you can figure it out without actually asking, in my case, under these circumstances, what is my price? But nobody asks the price. Nobody asks the price before they get the result, and nobody shops.
Yeah.
And here we have 25,000. I mean, you know, an MRI. What does an MRI cost? Who knows what an MRI costs?
No idea. I don't even know where to begin to calculate how much an MRI costs.
Do you know, Michael?
You mean if you go pay for it? Anywhere between $500 and several thousand dollars, I guess. But are you talking about what does it cost to do it?
No. What does it cost to get yourself an MRI?
Yeah. Thousands.
That's the point. A clinic on one side, on one block, may charge $500 to $800. And down the road, a hospital may charge $5,000 or $7,000. It's the same MRI, maybe even the same doctor, and exactly the same equipment.
So what's stopping somebody? So is it illegal for somebody to just be like, hey, I'm just going to charge you $500? It's just because they know that the amount of demand they're going
to get. It's not somebody saying that. It's hospitals saying that. Hospitals get to charge more because in theory, they provide services to the community that is not otherwise provided if you're a private, that if you're just practicing as a private doctor. And so they get some leeway to charge more.
I just don't understand how 17% of US GDP doesn't have a market.
That's like, exactly the question.
It blows my mind.
It's exactly the question.
So
sorry, go ahead, Hans.
I was going to ask if anyone here has a good anecdote that they can share on what happens to those private doctors who have those, you know, clinics that are down the road when the big healthcare system in the area knows that, you know, that's competition for them and they don't like it.
That's the $1 trillion question. And I call it the $1 trillion question because there are very few private doctors left. Why are there very few private doctors left? Because these massive institutions, which amount to monopolies, duopolies, or triopolies in every single state, are, quote, not-for-profit institutions protected, many of them protected against private doctors opening clinics in their state. Like North Carolina State, you have to go before a commission to get a license to open a clinic, to open an operating center or an independent center. And who sits in those boards, those committees that decide whether you get their license? The duopoly, you know, with the Blue Cross Blue Shield of North Carolina or Duke Medicine there are the existing powers that be sitting on that board deciding whether you can become their competitor. How many licenses do you think they grant?
Wow. Yeah.
A big fat zero. So the answer to your question, Hans, is that doctors are being squeezed out of independent medicine. Their practices are being taken over by these duopolies or these monopolies or these triopolies. And they get dictated to how they must treat patients, and their treatment of patients follows the charging rates that they're given, and they're given rules about how much they can say with how much what they can treat within a given consultation
set of presenting symptoms.
Yeah, and so the end of the result is that we have this constant declining of standard medicine and constantly rising prices. And so much of it turns around this price blindness issue.
Wow.
And so let me just add one more anecdote to that briefly. Please. So in a previous life, I provided services to an orthopedic clinic that they were, you know, it was a cooperation, a co-op of a whole bunch of orthopedic doctors, and it had been in existence for quite some time. And one of these big, it lives in Tyler, so it's called Azalea Orthopedics, and Christus, which is a huge health provider in Texas, bought up several of the hospitals in the area. And when they came to town, they started engaging in all the classic dirty tricks that you would expect for, you know, a union that comes into town. and tries to force everyone to join the union so that then they can, you know, go extort the main company. They engaged in all of those types of tactics to try and force these independent orthopedic doctors and surgeons to basically abandon the Azalea co-op so that they could actually grow their monopoly on, you know, providing orthopedic care in the East Texas area. And it was just, you know, crazy to watch. And I think that's kind of a standard playbook that you end up seeing when you pull back the covers in a lot of different areas of healthcare.
This is the story that has been repeated in every town and city in the country that has had independent medicine being practiced. And price blindness, or the lack of published prices, and the monopoly power of these not-for-profit hospitals that sprung up because Congress clamped down on doctor-owned hospitals because they thought doctor-owned hospitals would do this terrible deed. They have done the terrible deed on us.
Michael, go ahead.
I think that doctors are good at providing care. There are a few exceptions. I've seen doctors in my career of watching healthcare who were also good businessmen. And the ones who were most successful were the ones who became concierge or specialty care type physicians. The concierge care doctors will fire all of their patients, no longer take insurance, and tell a select few patients, I will be your concierge doctor. You can call me any time of any day, and I will provide your care. You just have to pay me $20,000 a year. And that's impossible for most American citizens, but for the ones who can afford it, it's the ultimate form of care. You know, I have a friend who does it, and he'll go golfing. The medical doctor will go golfing with a patient, and they'll spend that entire 18 holes talking about where that patient is and what kind of things they need right now. And but those, again, are the exceptions. And if we go back to this whole follow the money again, the provider is not a business person. They're subject to everything around them that is the business world that provides, where do I get the money to pay for my nurses and people in my clinic? And going back to Larry again, you know, you get a license for that from a state, and, you know, what do?
Let me ask you this question, Michael. So this layer that Larry just talked about that has this monopolistic tendency, how prevalent is that in all the different layers of the onion? Like, is that a common theme across all the layers? And is this why at the root, why this is such an impossible problem to solve? Because it's just every layer is incredibly entrenched and powerful. Is that a fair characterization?
Yeah, I think so. And you know, here's the crazy thing. When we started Teladoc, we were charging $35 for being the patient could put themselves into a queue, and a licensed practitioner would call them back in 12 minutes or less. This was in a time period where if you wanted care, you called the admin in the office and you went next Thursday. And when you went, you were paying $110 or more when you walked into that clinic. Now think about it this way. Our doctors could work 8 hours a day for us, or they could work 12 hours a day, 6 or 7 days a week in their practice. That $8 a day with a $35 fee, they could make $100,000 more working for us than working in a clinic. And again, who's getting paid for this? Hey, my child is sniffling. Hey, I broke my ankle. Hey, you know, what do I do? My heart is pounding really fast. Those kinds of questions were, and the doctor could take care of them over the phone and make more money doing it. And so we got...
And the customer paid less.
Yeah, the customer paid less. Right.
So guys, let's get moving faster because we have only touched the surface of the problem.
Oh, we're trying to solve this in an hour and a half. Okay.
We've got to drill deeper. We've got to drill deeper. So I want to wrap up the provider problem. Right now, everything's fee for service. And so the incentive is more procedures gives you more revenue. Incentivizes overutilization and unnecessary care. Where we heard this before. We've all heard of this. So the whole issue is volume over time, rushed appointments, limited partner interaction. We've all been to the doctor and told to get out in 10 minutes. Oh, doctor, I wanted to talk about this as well. Sorry, I can only talk about one thing in one appointment. Defensive medicine, unnecessary tests. What? Why? Because we need to avoid malpractice liability. And that's laid down by the hospital I work for. So provider consolidation, hospital markets highly concentrated, to Hans's point, and to my point about monopolies, duopolies, every city today has a monopoly or a duopoly of hospitals. Physician practices are all being consumed by these duopolies and triopolies. And price increase post-merger. There's no quality improvement, but prices constantly increase 6 to 18%. So the result is 20 to 30% of services provide no benefits, $150 billion in defensive medicine costs, regional monopolies driving up practice, and no incentive for prevention or coordination. Think about it. Your hospital is not really interested in helping prevent or, you know, improve your health. They're there to help improve the number of procedures they do to drive more revenue.
It's sick care, not healthcare.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's sick-making care. Providers profit from doing more, not from keeping patients healthy or achieving. And we can go on and on. I don't want to go on too much with these problems because I want to get to. So payers and government are broken market, dynamics. So the insurance market is a failure. The administrative overhead in the insurance market is like four times higher than Medicare, by the way. So private administrators are costing us four times as much as Medicare administrators are costing us. Think about it. The government is more efficient than these providers. I haven't been able to drill into that one deep enough to understand whether Medicare also requires additional administration over and above it. So that's an area of mystery for me, but it's an amazing stat. I couldn't get over it myself. So prior authorization is adding $31 billion to annual costs, delaying care and physician burnout. So all of this prior authorization stuff by the insurance, by your insurance, which is there to so-called reduce costs, of actually ballooned cost. Government failures. Medicare, Medicaid share is 45% of total healthcare spending. And the political constraints on that are very clear. Short election cycles versus long-term reform, special interest lobbying power. I mean, the healthcare community's lobbying must be amongst the strongest in the world, must be the largest in the country. Mm. And regulatory capture by industry. I mean, industry sits on these boards that regulate themselves. That's the reality. All of these giant monopolies, whether they're insurance monopolies, there are only a handful of insurance companies that control the insurance industry today. They sit on the boards. All these hospitals are monopolies. They sit on these boards. And who doesn't sit on the boards? You know, independent doctors, independent voters. So market concentration, insurance markets are highly concentrated. There's weak antitrust enforcement. And you know, the weird thing is antitrust do not enforce against the not-for-profits. And they are the biggest monopolists of all. No price transparency requirements and the certificate of needs laws. Those certificate of needs laws in many states are what I talked about, these committees sitting on and deciding who may or may not, you know, build an independent clinic.
Sorry, real quick, Larry. The antitrust enforcement. So is there something in law or something mechanically that says that nonprofits are protected from antitrust enforcement, or is it just there's no money to be made? Like, how, walk me through that, why there's so little antitrust enforcement with nonprofits.
I don't know. Maybe Michael knows the law on that, but I haven't seen antitrust really dealing with not-for-profits in the past.
I don't know.
And the thing about the antitrust is I think these monopolies are local monopolies or local duopolies. So if you want care in North Carolina, in the Research Triangle Park, there are really only two hospital systems you can go to.
Mm-hmm. Kind of like ISPs, yeah. In like certain regions. You only have one ISP, internet service provider.
But, or utility. You don't depend on your life for ISPs.
Yeah.
Well, I think care is regulated through the doctors in each of the 50 states. There is a licensing and governing group called the Board of Medical Examiners that kind of oversees licensing, and they're like little fiefdoms. And
that's licensing for doctors or licensing for hospitals?
For doctors, but remember, because of corporate practice of medicine, doctors have to be the ones in control. Because you can't have a corporation necessarily telling a doctor, this is the kind of care you can and cannot give, except in the case of a hospital, which your chief administrator needs to be a doctor, not a non-physician.
But these not-for-profits have become gigantic institutions who are there to perpetuate their existence and to facilitate the lives of their administrators and administrative boards and senior people. And they act no differently from a monopoly, a local monopoly or a national monopoly. They act in exactly the same way. They've caused prices to go up. They do this cost-plus model. I mean, everything that you would assign to a monopoly, all the bad practices you would assign to a monopoly, they conduct themselves in that fashion.
So OpenAI being nonprofit is a good idea.
It's a good idea for Sam.
So I think capitalism works really well until there is bureaucracy that stops or prevents the entrepreneurs or the innovation from coming in and fixing the broken problems. And that's, that was the issue we faced at Teladoc. When sheriffs walked into our office and said, you're going to prison, and they had the ability to throw us into prison, It was a difficult situation. And when bureaucrats that are getting their money from lobbyists are creating rules that protect the big entities that are making a lot of money, it's a problem. And so what we have to do, and Larry and I are going to be working on this in a roundtable beginning in the fall, we have to figure out how do we keep the great American innovation of capitalism and at the same time, not allow it to control all of the broken pieces of healthcare.
I want to turn to solutions now, because all I've talked about are the problems. I want to turn to solutions now, and as Michael
said,
some
of the problems, right? Not even all of the problems.
You're exactly right. I've skipped many, many slides. But the key is aligning incentives for better outcomes. So what do we mean by aligning? Patients must see prices before care. Patients must learn to shop. Shopping must be made easy. Easy is by publishing prices in an understandable fashion. Lower cost for higher value. We have the internet. The doctor can put the conditions into the internet, and the price alternatives that are offered for services, the quality of those services, the value of the services could be published to the patient for the patient's determination and decision-making. Mm-hmm. Providers got to be paid for outcomes. Look, you do an operation on somebody and they die, you get the same money that the guy who does the operation and the patient survives or the patient prospers. They should be paid for outcomes. If you do an operation and the patient dies, you shouldn't be paid. You must be rewarded for prevention, not for cure. I'm going to talk about prevention at length. In fact, you probably have to stop me. But That's what we don't do in the United States. And we, the public, participate in that in a big way through our eating habits and through our health habits and so on and so forth. We need coordinated care teams. And so providers have to stop being, you know, hospitals only interested in building bigger buildings and lots. Every city I go through, now that I travel so much on the roads and I travel through these cities, every city I go through, what's the one huge building still being built or the one complex still being expanded? What? There are no office buildings being built anymore. Nobody's going to office anymore. But in every city I go to, there's this huge construction going on. And what is it around? The hospitals. Why? Because these institutions have to expand. Why do they have to expand? I don't know. It's a compulsion of their administrators. Why is it a compulsion of their administrators? Because they want to earn bigger bucks. I mean, that's my guess. But anyway.
It's funny because you mentioned that I have a friend who he has a multi-year so he's in construction. The most demand they have is from the hospital network.
Yeah, that's it. That's it. Because they're the only people still attracting more and more and more money. And it's our money. We should stop giving them that money. And the only way to stop giving them that money is to force price transparency and publication of prices and only rewarding success. Payers must compete on value, not on cost shifting. Transparent pricing, administrative efficiency. Government has to enforce competition. We have antitrust laws. We must enforce them. We must enable transparency. We must focus on population health. So the principles I'm trying to espouse here are price transparency, market competition, value-based payment, and outcome measurement. If we can achieve those, and that is the one thing government can do. And by the way, I can't see, other than the lobby, I can't see either party or any of the parties being opposed to these principles.
I think the very frustrating thing for me, by the way, this is a phenomenal slide to sort of like to really put together is like, hey, like as per usual, creating a market that has good incentives will solve the problem. You know, that seems to be like a formula.
You should have written the slide. You would have done a much better job than I did. I got into the gory details, but you're absolutely on target.
But the details is what sort of explains it, right? I think the very frustrating thing is, you know, we live in a capitalistic society. And the reason why we have a government is to ensure that the capitalistic society doesn't go off the rails and starts creating monopolies or start creating bad outcomes. And the role of government should be to fix, like this should be the number one problem for the country almost, right?
Yeah.
And it's doing the opposite.
Right.
That is the most, like we have, how many people in Congress do we have? How many administrators, how many different, like how many millions of people work with government? I know there are a bunch of different, you know, a bunch of different like sort of like, you know, industries and they work in different things. But the size of the government is gigantic and their budget is gigantic. And this is literally what government is for, is to fix this. And they don't. And that's incredibly frustrating.
So this slide kind of sums up what could be done at a government level in terms of solving the problem. This does require change of behavior of government. It does require legislation. But every single solution that I'm presenting here, which is at a high level, I admit, should not be party politics. It should be all acceptable principles to everybody involved. And here's the thing. It doesn't involve money. The government doesn't have to spend any money. And can you imagine the savings that would result? I mean, here is a huge opportunity to reduce the budget deficit by simply implementing these simple core alignment principles. And a lot of it can be done without legislation, but some of it, much of it, requires legislation and enforcement by the government. So we do need a law that forces price transparency. We do need a law that incents the payment for outcomes and not volume. We do need a law that forces payers to actually, you know, be transparent about their pricing. So, yeah.
I would almost say, like, even just price transparency and having a market would probably solve 80% of the problems.
Well, that honestly. Is what Dutch Rojas has taught us. That is what Dutch Rojas said, and I think that he's right. I think it'd go a long way. But there are now some other there are other aspects that we could go on to, and that is the problem of spending on preventable diseases. We are spending most of our time fixing what is broken. Mm. We're not spending time or money on avoiding things breaking. We spend $4 trillion treating diseases that could be prevented for a fraction of the cost. Here are some of the cost items: diabetes, cardiovascular, mental health, and obesity. $4 trillion. Most chronic diseases are preventable. Rates are increasing, not decreasing. System profits from treating, not preventing. Prevention gets less than 1% of healthcare expenditure.
How much of the diabetes one is the food pyramid?
It absolutely is a massive proportion of it. Mm. Probably the biggest single one of it. And you know, just sugar water is a huge component of that. Mm-hmm. And I know that RFK Jr. is focused on that, and I hope that he can solve it. But the sugar lobby, believe it, I mean, in Mexico, they passed a law against sugar, you know, and it's had enormous results because Mexico suffers from a more serious diabetes problem than we do. And they've had a huge impact on it by, you know, passing a law against sugar or passing a tax on sugar. And our sugar, you know, lobby solved that. The lobby is the biggest problem. It's not party politics anymore. It's lobby politics. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't matter whether you're in this party or you're that party or you're starting a new party. If you can't solve the lobby, you can't solve the problem.
In the beginning, when we talked about Ben Franklin's ounce of prevention and pound of cure, what we're seeing in that total chronic $4 trillion, that's the pound of cure. Larry, do you have a sense yet? What is the ounce of prevention or the gram of prevention? What would it cost to get rid of that pound of cure with our ounce of prevention?
Could be done at no cost at all. It could be done at a savings.
Yeah.
We could tax sugar water, you know, and that would have a huge impact. Now, mental health, that's a whole nother conversation. Yeah. You're probably in a better position to talk about that than I. And we've actually seen several technologies that could be very helpful in that regard. But obesity and diabetes, that is the whole issue of the food pyramid that RFK Jr. is so passionate about. And that's not going to cost money. In fact, we could tax the hell out of that stuff. Tax the hell out of sugar and tax the hell out of starches, the starch feedstuffs. And we'd be in great position. I mean, we could tax the hell out of McDonald's, you know?
If we would just stop subsidizing corn, like, we don't even have to tax it necessarily. If you just stop subsidizing so many of the things that we subsidize, I think that would even go a long way.
Exactly right. So, you know, and then the admin waste. Now, this slide I have less confidence of because we talk about Medicare's, we're only paying 2% of Medicare expenditures is spent on admin. Yet all these private insurers spend 30% on admin. I think there's a saving to be had, but I don't think it's 28%. So, but the numbers are very, 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 very stark. Even if we say, okay, Medicare, you know, they're only spending this, but a lot of their admin is being done within here. That was the criticism that I got of the slide. And I think it's a fair criticism, but look at the international average. I mean, it's less than a third, much less than a third of what we're spending. And this money just goes into private pockets. It goes into, you know, the healthcare companies' pockets. And they don't care. In fact, they love it because they get to charge premiums based upon that expenditure. Mm-hmm. So, you know, this is a huge problem. And the problem is because there's lack of transparency and because these people, you know, earn premiums based on how much they pay, they don't mind paying very high charges. The price transparency is play in lack of price transparency plays into their hands. And by the way, insurers pay a lot more for care than they should. Well, that's a whole, I don't want to go down that rat hole. There are so many rat holes here, guys. It's incredible.
And I think that really speaks to it, right? You know, once you, and I know that like there's so much more to the story, but that once you just take a little bit of time to understand the problem, right? The core issues, like the price discovery one, is such an obvious problem. And the fact that it's not addressed speaks to how entrenched this is. The solution is obvious to me.
Look at
it,
this.
It almost feels
physicians
like.
Spend 2 hours on admin per patient hour.
That's crazy.
Every hour they sit.
Wow.
There are 1,300 plus different insurance forms. Physicians burn out from bureaucracy and treatment delays from prior authorizations. Mm. Prior authorizations are costing $31 billion in this administration cost. Billing complexity is costing $150 billion. But, I mean, $31 billion, I mean, $150 billion, $50 billion for claims processing, $200 billion for insurance overhead. I mean, these numbers are just stunning, guys.
Insane.
$400 billion goes to bureaucracy instead of patients' care, 15 times higher than Medicare's efficient three times higher, more than three times higher.
And what's crazy is Medicare, correct me if I'm wrong, Medicare is for the oldest people in our society generally.
Yeah, which
is that
means
not correct?
Their costs are higher. So it plays into Medicare's favor that they supply the oldest in terms of administrative costs. So it's not exactly a negative.
Okay.
It's a, you know, it's.
Okay, okay.
Yeah. And then there's market concentration. This is my, you know, this is me hopping on to the duopoly and the monopolies. Hospital markets are 60%. That's highly concentrated. Insurance markets, insurance companies are 70%. The top three insurers are 70% of the market. Price increase post-merger. Every time a hospital system merges in order to become more economic and to become, you know, to improve their costs, prices go up by between 6 and 18%. Just proving my point that these monopolies are bad, bad, bad news.
So hold on a second. So when they merge, prices go up?
Yeah.
Don't you merge to try and create synergy and to try
That's
to create?
That's what they tell us. That's what they're trying to do. They're trying to create efficiency and synergy.
Yeah. And that's why they have to charge more.
Guys, this is the most unbelievable part of this whole exercise. You can get an appendectomy in the same city, somewhere between $8,000 and $35,000. How much would you want to pay?
I'm going to go for $8,000, Larry.
Yeah, but your insurance is going to go for the $35,000.
Of course they are.
So, Larry, if it's a Mercedes versus a low-end Ford, then that's a different kind of question, right? But that's not what you're saying here.
I'm saying exactly what you're
Same
saying.
Same level of care.
They're both Fiat.
Both Mercedes. Exactly
both
equivalent.
Fiats.
Yeah. They're both Fiat. No, it may be the same doctor. It may be the very same doctor.
Yeah.
Hey, the Fiat 500 is a pretty cool
car. And by
the way,
the $8,000 thing may give you a better outcome than the $35,000. Same
it's nonsensical. It's nonsensical. It makes no sense. It just makes no sense. Level of care, pricing, there's literally nothing because there's no market. And if there was a market, the higher price item would be theoretically better than the lower price item.
Guys, we're business people. Do we think that the higher price indicates better service, better quality?
You mean in healthcare or just generally?
No, in anything.
Generally speaking, if you pay more for something, you get better something better.
Yeah.
Generally speaking.
If there's a market.
If there's a market. And if there's not some sort of unbelievable innovation that has just broken through, right, like, exactly, you know, robotaxi as an example.
Exactly.
Two slides back, you use the word competition. I think that's what's relevant here.
Competition and price transparency, both are very important because there is competition. Look here, guys, there's competition. Here it is. There's real competition. But does anybody think about going and getting a competing price? When last did you go and get a competing price for a medical process, for a medical procedure? When did you do that last?
I'm a little closer to it, but I understand what you're saying. I do call and ask, and I do try and negotiate. Okay. If I'm paying for it, then I'm an entrepreneur, so I pay my own insurance. I don't have the big entity over me paying those things.
Okay. Baza, do you shop your procedures?
I mean, I can't remember the last time. I mean, the dentist, I did, you know, but I went with the one that gave me the better care.
Okay.
You know, but that's the dentist.
So when your wife had a baby, did you shop for that process?
We looked around, but we didn't shop for the price. We shopped for who she felt most comfortable with because it was deeply personal for her. Yeah.
All right.
But so, this could be part of the problem, right? So it's funny what I just talked about,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, it is part of the
but
problem.
But Larry, I think to your point, you know, I have a lot of knowledge in the healthcare space. But think about the average musician, average construction worker. They don't know how to ask these questions. And they
that's
don't.
Right.
And that's the vast majority of the population.
We need an Amazon for doctors.
I ran a company. Well, Amazon tried it and they failed. But look, I ran a company. I owned the company. And I went blindly to the hospital my insurer sent me to. Yeah. I blindly did whatever my insurer told me to do. I blindly paid the first, you know, guys, I'm as guilty as everybody. I just didn't think about it.
Yeah.
So...
But
the solution is in competition and transparency reforms. And, you know, we understand this price and quality transparency, antitrust enforcement. I mean, can you imagine if every doctor had to put his outcomes, post it, and every facility had to put their prices and their outcome percentages, or their prices and outcome percentages next to each other, and maybe had to do their competitors as well. And you could look at it on the board and see, or on the internet. Do you think you would have shopped the way you shopped last time for whatever procedure you just had?
That was my Amazon comment, right? So like, so why is Amazon so incredible? If I type freaking power cord, it will give me the best power cords with the sponsored ones at the top that want to be at the top, but I can see the price and I can see the reviews.
Yep.
And I go with the one that has the ratio that I find best suits me.
Exactly.
But that doesn't exist. Like this is so. And one of the reasons why, for example, my dentist example when my wife was trying to find the OBGYN. There is nowhere for us to go in and make a good decision. Like we have to literally call. This feels like 1942. I literally have to call everybody, and then with everything else that we spend money on or try to use, there are marketplaces or places we can go to make an informed decision. With healthcare, it's the opposite. There's just walls everywhere.
And here's the interesting thing: your wife shopped and she found the person she was most comfortable with. But she didn't know.
At the time, by the way.
At the time, yeah, all right. And she didn't know that person's actual track record.
No, the best way she could gauge that is by going to Google Maps and pulling up her practice and reading the Google reviews. That was the only way she could do that.
Right.
Yeah.
So it's, you know, it's fascinating. Anyway, I have projected savings.
Which, by the way, were not accurate.
I mean, that's the point I was trying to drive at. Had there been outcome results?
Yeah.
And look, it could be that the doctor who's the rudest and the nastiest and who got the worst comments maybe is the best doctor. Mm-hmm. Maybe had the best medical outcomes. Yeah. So unless you know the medical outcomes, you really don't understand what is the quality of the service.
There's one more layer, though, Farzad. You were talking in the Amazon analogy. There's a tool, and I think it's going away, unfortunately. It's called FakeSpot, which will go out and analyze all the Amazon reviews and grade them. Because we know that a lot of vendors, you know, and in this healthcare engine, the large corporations, the large hospital systems, they could create their own fake reviews or only, you know, block. And the great thing about FakeSpot was it goes out and independently analyzes all the reviews and then gives you a grade or F.
Well, Amazon, you know, Amazon now have, they have a certificate, some form of certifying that the review is probably real.
Yeah, from somebody who previously purchased from this customer. Like it will prioritize the ones where the account that actually bought the product left a review for that product.
But those get gamed too. I have to drop off. Thank you for letting me crash the conversation. I've learned a lot. Had fun.
Thanks Hans. See ya.
Hans, I hope you watch the rest because there's a lot more to learn.
I will.
Thanks, Hans. Appreciate you being here. So I want to move quickly to some of the what I think is the solution. By the way, none of these solutions require some sort of political animosity between the parties. All of this could be done, you know, on a bipartisan basis. So if we had reference pricing, physician-owned clinics licensed by a non-competitor, and if we had transparency, I think these are the numbers that we would save. In year one alone, $50 billion. In year two, $200 billion. By year three, we would be saving about $350 billion, which is not bupkis.
Yeah, it's, what is that, one-third of our defense budget?
That's right. That's right.
Or one-third of our interest payments on our debt?
So providers are rewarded for doing more procedures and not keeping more patients. This is the waste for defensive medicine, duplicative tests, and unnecessary services. I just want to skip over this because we've talked about this at fair length. And move on to value-based payment models. If we get, you know, alternative payment models are capitation, which is fixed payment per patient, bundle payments, single payments for an episode of care rather than, you know, a CPT code, shared savings where providers share in cost reductions and pay for performance, bonuses for quality metrics. And so looking at all of these possibilities, and I don't want to go into too great detail because we did study multiple different of these strategies with different providers to estimate the savings. And we came up with a projected impact of up to $200 billion and a 15% cost reduction across it. And we did that by looking at some of these systems like Geisinger and Kaiser. And I think they could be very successful. And then just moving on quickly, this whole idea of treating disease instead of preventing it. So prevention is one of the biggest issues. And it's the issue that RFK is trying to tackle, and it's diet and reactive medicine, you know, and it's behavior. And so this is an area where we could save enormous amounts of money. And here it's diet, exercise, lifestyle, and it's how to get a whole population realigned in their behaviors. So this is, you know, this is a very hard nut of the prevention side of the problem. And it's the side that, you know, again, it could be tackled completely in a bipartisan fashion. I'm not sure RFK is doing that in the most bipartisan possible way, but he's definitely started down that track.
Yeah, and the behavioral piece, I mean, it's like, you know, if I think about my own research, getting good sleep, exercising, eating good food, and keeping your stress levels low-ish, that's like 90% of it. To me, it feels
that's
like,
exactly
right?
That's exactly right.
Boy, that's so hard to do for, you know, when you have two kids and you're working two jobs and your wife has a job and you can't afford the nanny and you're stressed all the time, you know, that's when it gets weird.
And you live in a food desert where the only provider is McDonald's.
And what percentage of the country lives like that?
A large percentage. I drive around, you know, I do a lot of travel on the road now. And I get to a point where I'm stopping at a charging station and all I can get is junk food.
Yep.
Yeah. It's brutal.
It is brutal. And the potential impact is gigantic. You know, we're potentially looking at $1.5 trillion of savings. And for every dollar we invest in prevention, it saves something like $3 to $5 of treatment cost. And here, you know, it kind of reflects on the population. So, you know, we need this population health approach. We need the issue of food improvement. We need wellness, workplace at the wellness. We need, you know, people to stop smoking. Yeah. There are so many aspects to this that touch on our lifestyle, and it's something that all of us can contribute towards. And it's a really big number. It's a really big number.
And you just gave a numerical answer to the sort of ounce of prevention, pound of cure. But there's another piece that's much bigger, and that is if I catch cancer at stage one, it's a lifestyle change. If I catch cancer at stage four, it's a doctor and a facility saying, chemo, radiation, surgery, your life is definitely going to be changed. You probably will die. And that is a piece of it that you can't put a dollar value on. And it creates another thing that you haven't included in the math here, but we all need to be thinking about that. And that is me as a productive member of society. And I'm not talking about Michael Gorton specifically, but anybody who catches it at stage one stays productive. They keep contributing to the society and to the art and engineering and everything else. And when they hit stage four and they go through all of that, they don't anymore. Their value drops. And I'm not saying that to be mean or anything, but their capabilities to run a marathon after stage four typically go close to zero.
Yeah. I mean, that's absolutely right. You know, I mean, when you think about it, Finland managed to reduce their cardiac deaths by 85% through population behavioral changes. So it can be done. It's theoretically possible to be done.
Yeah. Just behavioral changes, 85% less.
85% cardiac.
That's unbelievable.
Wow. But it's true. So, guys, there's an 8-year roadmap that I've kind of constructed.
Okay. We should have led with this slide. What the hell?
It's a straw man. Listen, I'm not here to prescribe policy. I'm here to give an exemplar of what good policy may look like.
Love it.
But it's an 8-year roadmap, which, you know, I think everybody could say kumbaya over. Everyone. Because none of this is going to be out of our budget pockets. None of this is going to impose upon our budget. And I will say we've got a great Secretary of Health, RFK Jr. I know that he's got some crazy ideas, or people think it's crazy ideas, or people haven't heard his, but I know he's a little crazy. I understand that, and I stipulate that, but he is signed on to this. And we have a, you know, and this is something that I'd love Elon to weigh in on, but phase one is price transparency. In year one and two, price and quality transparency, reference pricing, reference and public quality scoring. I can get into the nitty-gritty of this, but we already have some of the machinery to do this. Phase two is competition, antitrust, physician-owned hospital labs, years 2 to 4. Phase three is payment reform, value-based payment and bundling, which really depends upon phase one and two, and that comes in year 3 and 6. And phase four, prevention, that's a longer term, you know, lifestyle change takes this time, and that we get to in year 5 and 8. And, you know, John Kennedy, my hero, challenged an entire nation to become fit and healthy. And it worked. In those years, it worked. It had a real impact. if a president would step forward and do that, I think it would have a real impact. And here are the metrics, guys, that these numbers, I mean, I've worked these numbers. You can challenge them if you wish, but they're definitely in the ballpark. They rise from $100 billion a year to $800 billion a year. That is not small change. That can have a real impact. And, you know, if Elon wants us to get us to a balanced budget, this is the way forward. Because I want to tell you, on the road that we're on, whereas we have that cumulative savings, we would have cumulative increases. So you can imagine the impact of what happens if we stay on the same course.
I love it. Yeah, I think what's interesting about this slide is, you know, I'm trying to be realistic about human nature. And
yes,
I think with the state of the United States, if I think about all the different metrics that we've seen for the last few decades, so we know health outcomes have been terrible. Obesity, something like 40% of the country is obese and has been climbing for the last couple decades. Same thing with anxiety and depression. Then we have, the economy for the bottom half of the country is not working the way it should in a lot of different places. We have an issue with the younger generations being saddled with massive amounts of debt that can't enter the workforce necessarily in the way that they thought they could, in addition to it being disrupted by artificial intelligence and soon be robotics, right? And so from my perspective, you know, I think this podcast and sort of the discoveries that we've made and the issues that we've highlighted, I think have the best chance to be truly taken up by, like, say, that John Kennedy type figure once we are able to get the country in a little bit better economic situation. Because then I think that will remove the stress of a lot of the people that know they have to make behavioral changes, but their lives are, they're just simply too freaking stressed out with all the shit that they have to deal with, right? If we think behavioral is a big percentage of it, that is one way of doing it, right? And if I think about my own arc, like as an individual, when I was up and coming and I left college with $100,000 in debt, my net worth was negative 120, whatever, 120,000, whatever it was. We were just exiting the financial crisis. Was I really focusing on my health? No. I was focusing on getting myself out of the shit situation that I was in from a monetary perspective, right? And I think that's a lot of this country. I think a lot of this country is in that sort of place.
I get it, Farzad, but I'll challenge you.
Yeah, please.
If you look at my program, phase one is not changing people's behavior.
I agree.
Forcing price transparency.
I agree 100%.
So I think we can implement this program today, and
we can do both.
It'll play into helping people reduce their stress.
100%.
Improving their quality of life, improving their understanding of what they're getting into.
I was speaking more from a John Kennedy type figure that puts the stamp, like puts the seal in it and says, once and for all, we're going to move forward.
I get it.
And I'm totally on board with you as well. 100%.
Okay. You know, I'd actually like to make a closing statement because I just have a couple minutes. And I think that a month or two ago, Larry sent me this document and I opened it up and I saw a PowerPoint that was 22 pages in it. And a document that was 68 or so. And I thought, oh man, what is this going to be? But I had a great deal of respect and admiration for Larry Goldberg. And so I said, I'm going to at least start reading it. And the more I read, the more I saw thought and thought leadership. And I think I want to draw an analogy because in a few weeks, the three of us are going to be in Nashville, Tennessee, meeting with one of the great economists of all time. And I've heard Larry say more than once, Art Laffer should have a Nobel Prize. And
he's the greatest economist that never won the Nobel Prize.
And I think, you know, what Art has done for economics has been pretty significant. What we're about to tackle, and Larry, excuse me for saying this, but I think this is your Nobel Prize. This work is unbelievable because you've actually put together a plan that I think could be implemented. It's going to be a huge, huge battle, but You know, again, I'm going to go back to when I first looked at it and went, oh my gosh, how am I going to get through 68 pages of this thing? And now, you know, I'm thinking, let's go make this happen. I'm raising my hand. I think we get this done, Larry Goldberg gets the Nobel.
Oh, 100%. Without a shadow of a doubt. I mean, this is one of the great issues of our time.
It is.
Yeah. For sure.
And you know, the political strategy that, you know, I'm trying to focus on, that I've focused on right through this thing, is not to be partisan.
Yeah.
To be specifically nonpartisan. And so I think that's the most important part of this whole plan.
Yeah.
Is that, you know, we focus on this being a bipartisan approach. Mm. I did do a diagram which I thought would be quite interesting to show where the money's flowing from right now and into.
And where it's tough to read on the slides.
You know, we'll put it on the deck. I mean, it just shows you that, you know, reallocation of the money is really the same money reallocated will just save so much money and so many lives. So this is the summary, guys. $800 billion to $1 trillion in annual savings, benefits for everyone and every political party, and we can improve our life expectancy by 4 years. I need that quite badly at this stage because, you know, according to this, I'm going to die next year.
I thought you're a hologram. You're going to be around forever.
And we'll reduce the chronic diseases, you know. So this is our choice, and we have to act.
I love it.
Yeah.
No better way to end it. I mean, it really does show. I mean, I think taking something like this on is so freaking daunting to anybody. It's so daunting. The government hasn't even sniffed it.
Yeah.
And we know, and we can see what the problems are, and we can see what the solutions are. So the fact that you went through and put in the effort, Larry, you have a lot going on. And I think the audience will see just how much time you've spent in putting everything together. And for everyone out there that's watching this, that knows this is a problem, the best way to get the train started on fixing this shit is to, like, just be openly talking about this all the time and let every single representative and anyone you have access to in government that represents you, let them know that this is your number one issue. Because we have to get this fixed. We have to get this fixed. It's putting our country in a terrible direction fiscally. We are suffering because of it, because we're all dying sooner, getting fatter, have worse behaviors. We're all suffering from this, all of us, right? And there are ways to fix it. It's just we have to tackle a behemoth of a problem, but we have to do it. We have to do it.
Winston Churchill said, Americans get everything wrong as many ways as they can possibly get it wrong before they finally get it right. And I think we're done with that part now. Now let's get it right.
Yeah, let's get it right. Let's get it right. Absolutely. Thank you guys very much, man. Larry, thank you so much for the work you put into this. Michael, thank you so much for making the time, for bringing your expertise and taking the time to do this as well. Did you guys have any parting thoughts or any last thoughts before we wrap the sucker up?
I gave my conclusion.
Good. I love it. Larry, did you want to one-up it or are you good?
No, I think you guys did brilliantly in wrapping it up for me.
Fantastic. All right, everybody. All right. Make sure you go check out Michael Gordon and his book, Gordon. One more time, where can people find your book?
On Amazon. It's called Telemedicine Wars.
Love it. And we'll have a link for that in the description. All right, everybody.
All right.
Bye-bye.
See ya.